such a mind.
This is February 4th, right? 4th?
Is
it 4th? Yeah, 2009 in Hilo.
You know, think about it. It's like the sound of one hand clapping.
It's a Zen experience, even imagine.
How do you even begin?
I have a sister-in-law that's deaf, and she said she wouldn't have it any other way.
She prefers deafness.
She prefers deafness, because she's lived in silence for so long. When they tried to fix her up with hearing aids, she couldn't take it.
That's interesting.
Wow.
And it's strange, because she's a member of a whole deaf community, and they came over to my sister's house for some holiday. And my sister said it was the strangest holiday ever, because there was no noise of people gathering.
Well, that was like
together.
When I did that kirtan at the deaf school, and there was no sound. So you've got 25 people chanting, but the room is silent.
What did you do?
I was chanting the sign language just like they were.
Okay.
And, you know, it was very interesting.
But actually, I mean, there is this beauty in that, though. There's this actual silence that's just amazing when you're in that space.
There was.
Just a very deep silence.
It was a very transformative experience.
And were there silent cartels?
No, it was just silence. But before that, I'd been giving a class, and I'd been telling stories about Krishna, and people were very eager to ask questions. And, you know, I had to have an interpreter.
Right.
One thing I point out in the article was that normally with an interpreter, I try to sit next to the translator so that people can see my body language and hear my tone of voice. But when you have a sign language interpreter, it's all visual. They
yes,
have to be completely just looking at the interpreter. They never look at you for a moment. It's almost like you weren't there.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah,
that's
quite
so
interesting.
So now I have an idea of what Zen Harinam would be like.
Uh-huh. Okay. Can I get some water?
You're out of chanting
Cheers.
Without chanting.
So should I just chant Hare Krishna?
Silence of chanting.
Yeah, that's what we chant.
Chanting it as you like. Is it Prabhupada's pranams?
Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nithi Name. Thank you. Prem Shikhoshi Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nichan and Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shivasari Gora Bhakti Vindiki Jaya Shri Shri Radha Krishna Go Gopina Shaima Kunda Radha Kunda Giri Govardhan Ki Jaya Vrindavan Dham Ki Jaya Tour Dham Ki Jaya Navadri Mayapur Dham Ki Jaya Jagannath Puri Dham Ki Jaya Gangamai Jamuna Devi Ki Jaya Bhakti Devi Ki Jaya Tulsi Maharani Ki Jaya Samaveta Bhakti Vindiki Ki Jaya Gora Premanandam All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Varanga. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Yutha Padakamalam Sri Guru Vaishnavam Cha Sri Rupam Sakajatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitham Samasajivam Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parishana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Devam Sahagana Raghunatham Sri Vishakam Cha. So I had something planned for tonight, and I can go ahead with that plan, or we can adjust if you have something else that you would like to talk about. I wanted to talk about some very famous verses in the Bhagavad Gita, commonly known as the fall down sequence. Yes, chapter 2, texts 62 and 63. And I wanted to use these verses to explain how we can turn matter to spirit. However, if there is something that anybody would like to talk about instead, we can. Other than how to turn matter into spirit. Mm-hmm. We're going to have a little lesson in alchemy here. But if there's something else that you would like to discuss, we can go for that as well, in addition or instead or whatever.
Yeah, can
yes.
we have a couple of questions?
If we can turn spirit into matter, it just seems like it would make it so much easier.
Okay. We can also do that. Yes. So if what you can do is you just play my class backwards,
right?
And you will learn how to turn spirit into matter. Okay, anything else?
Just if there can be questions at the end.
There can be questions at the end, and if you have a really, really pressing question, you can even ask it in the middle. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I even have notes that are written in a red pen, because I wrote these while I was homeschooling some of my grandkids. And what we did was we all took these verses and thought about what we could say about them. And I had my teacher's red pen, so I was writing my notes about that. When we're in materialistic consciousness, basically we have the mentality of everything is mine. I've got a grandson who's almost 2, and one of his brothers said, you know, he thinks everything in the house is his. And I said, basically, we all have that mentality, but because we're a little civilized, we don't act on it. But we'd like to think, well, really everything, I wish everything were mine. I mean, he's thinking all the ping pong balls, all of the whatever, the dolls in the house are all his, and anyone else who takes it. And the result of that is that he is often what? Very unhappy. Because it's not truth. So he spends a lot of time lamenting about something that was never true in the first place. That someone is using something that is mine. Someone is prohibiting me from getting something that's mine. Now, one of the other kids just got some ping pong balls for his birthday. And the little one, as I said, he's almost 2. He'll take some of the balls and he'll take the paddle and whack the ball on the floor with it. And pretty soon the ball, of course, becomes dented, or after a while it just breaks up into little pieces. And then he'll come and say, broken, broken, I want another one. So he thinks not only that everything belongs to him, but everything belongs to him in the sense that I can do whatever I want with it. Not that something's been given me to steward, to husband, to care for, to protect. But what I have is mine and mine to do with as I please, including to destroy it. And if I destroy it, well, I should be given another one pronto. So this again brings him a lot of unhappiness. Now, the unhappiness is not so much coming from the fact that not everything belongs to him and that things break, but because he has this mentality of seeing that everything's mine to do with as I please. Now, spiritual mentality is I see that everything belongs to God. Everything belongs to the absolute truth. And that things are given to me to care for and to protect and to cherish and to nurture, to take care of for some limited amount of time. And nothing is really mine. If something comes, it comes. If something goes, it goes. I neither desire things to come nor do I lament when they go, because after all, they weren't mine. Right? Someone says, here, would you watch my dog for me while I go in the store? You know, I'm just watching that for the owner. I'm not hankering or lamenting. So it's the same circumstance, but the consciousness is different. And someone who has the mood that nothing is mine, I don't possess anything, and whatever I so-called possess is really just for me to take care of, such a person will always feel satisfied and peaceful. So these two, as I say, very famous verses. We'll also look at the Sanskrit. The Sanskrit here is important, and I'm not going to get into it in depth, but we'll just look a little bit. Dayato vishayan punsam sangas teju prajayate sangat sanjayate kama kama krodha vijayate krodhad bhavati sammoha sammohat smriti vibrama smriti brahma sadbhut smriti brahma sadbhutina so bhutina sad pranasyati. And what's particularly interesting is the first word, jayato, which is very much reminds us of the word dhyana. And if any of you are familiar with yoga, dhyana means to meditate. We talk about dhyan yoga. Dhyan yoga is where somebody has the proper mudras and the proper pranayama, you know, etc. And goes into a state of trance. That's dhyana. So this starts with the word jayato, which means to meditate on. And Srila Prabhupada translates these two verses while contemplating the objects of the senses. Now, the word he's translating as contemplating is this word that means meditate. While contemplating the objects of the senses, well, we have things that we see, things that we hear, things that we touch, things we smell, things we say. A person develops attachment for them. And from such attachment, lust develops, and from lust, anger arises. So we have contemplation, which in this sense is really meditation. You're thinking about something, you're thinking about it, you're meditating on it. From that, you become attached. I want it. It's my right to have it. And from that attachment, lust develops. So lust here doesn't just refer to sexual desire, but refers to this intense desire for something. I must have it, and I don't care what the price is. And to me, what epitomizes this is Bill Clinton having an affair. You know, so he's the president of the United States, and he's willing to risk his position as president of the United States in order to have an affair. So this is lust. Lust is, I don't care what price I'm going to have to pay for this. I don't care what the negative consequences are going to be. It just doesn't, I don't think about it, and I just don't care. I want it, and I want it now, and whatever I have to do. That's the difference between attachment and lust. Attachment is, yes, I want it, I want it, I want it, and lust is, the matter. You know, whatever the consequences. And from that intense desire comes anger. Now, why anger? So I'm going to do this in a shortened form, but sometimes I do a full exercise with a group. And if we think about things that we really want, that we have some attachment for, or what to speak of if we have lust for, you know, all of the things that we've ever desired in our life, there's a certain percentage that we never got at all in any form. Yeah, I just never got them. Some people, they never got a spouse, never got a kid, or they never got their own house, or they never got the job. There's something you just didn't get. And then there were the things that we got them, and they weren't what we thought they would be. You know, you bought a house, you spent your life savings on a house, and you find out the pipes are leaking in the walls. And you found out the neighborhood's not what it's supposed to be. You moved your family, you got this job, and, you know, they're just asking you to do menial work that isn't very interesting. you buy some gadget and it doesn't do the thing you want it to do. And then there are the things that we wanted them, we got them, and they were perfect, and all those things are temporary. You got the perfect spouse, the perfect house, and everything's going to go. Either the thing's going to go or you're going to go. You're not going to get to keep it. Therefore, from lust comes anger. Anger that I didn't get it, anger that it wasn't what I thought it would be, or anger that I'm going to lose it, or when I do lose it. And because everything in this world is in that category, is there anything in this world, any sense object, that you get it, it's perfect, and you get to keep it? Nothing. Zero. So therefore, from lust comes anger. And then the next verse, from anger, delusion arises. And from delusion, bewilderment of memory. When memory is bewildered, intelligence is lost. And when intelligence is lost, one falls down again into the material pool. So we know that when we become angry, we lose our sense. Under the influence of anger, most people I know have done or said something that they would not have done or said in a normal state of consciousness. Something that later on you say, why did I do that? Why did I say that? You know, you're angry and you take something and you break it. Or you say to a person that you care about, that you live with, you know, I hate you. And you become bewildered. And you become bewildered not only in that kind of sense, but you become bewildered about what reality is. You forget that the real source of your anger was your original attachment and lust. You think the source of your anger is that you didn't get the thing or it wasn't what you wanted or it's temporary. And if I could just get that thing, I'd be happy. The anger bewilders you. You see the world in terms of friends and enemies, in terms of favorable and unfavorable circumstances. You think that people are out to get you. You start getting into a blaming mentality and an attacking mentality. You lose sight of reality. You become bewildered. Your memory is lost. You know, we have so many resolutions that we make. Yes, I'm going to be this kind of person, and I'm going to do this kind of thing, and I'm going to act this way, and yes, I'm going to do that. And then we get angry. It's all gone. We get bewildered. We can't remember any of those things. We lose our memory. And when we lose our memory, we lose our intelligence. And that is material consciousness. Now, the sad thing about this is that a person in material consciousness is in this state all the time, more or less. And we're so accustomed to it. It's like somebody who's living by, okay, well, we used to live by a railroad track in North Carolina. And the first night we bought the house, I got woken up by the trains. After that, I never noticed it anymore. And one time, some people were visiting me from California. We were sitting out on the deck. We're talking. And all of a sudden, they just look at me. They're just staring at me. I said, what's wrong? They said, do you always just sit calmly when there's an earthquake? I said, no, it's a train. I didn't even notice it anymore. What to speak of if you're by some place where there's some constant noise? You know, some fan or some machinery, right?
Cokie frogs.
You just don't notice it. Or myself, I've been around a lot of little kids for a long time, almost all my adult life, and I don't notice it. You know, when they're screaming and yelling, I don't hear it. And people who haven't been around kids, they'll say, how do you stand it? Stand what? Right? I'm not aware of it. So when we're in material consciousness, there's an underlying current of anger that is constantly present. Constant. And we don't notice it. We just think it's normal. We think this is just how I feel. This is what it just feels like to exist. But as long as we're meditating on the concept that things in this world that touch my body senses, you know, as they say now, eye candy, you know, something beautiful for my eyes, something attractive for my ears, something nice for my nose, my mouth, my sense of touch, that those are the things that are the source of my happiness. As long as I'm in that mentality, I'm going to be constantly angry. Because something's not going to be working out at any one moment in time. We're not going to ever be in a position where we say, yes, I have every single thing that I want and I'm going to get to keep it. Right? And anger is very mixed up with fear because we're afraid. Is this going to disappoint me? When is it going to leave? I think of it like you're eating a nice meal and there's some, you know, police officer behind you with a gun. Do I get to finish?
I don't know.
As soon as I get my orders from headquarters, I take your way. You know, you don't know. Do I eat the dessert first, last? Am I going to get to finish everything on my plate? And therefore, our intelligence is constantly covered. We cannot see things as they are. We really don't see truth. We think, I see reality. Oh, there's a book, this is a floor, this is a wall. But my ability to see the truth has become covered. I don't see things as they are. And I don't even know that I don't see things as they are. I think how I see things is how they are. As I said, this sequence is happening. Sometimes it's very gross. You know, we want something very intensely and we get very visibly angry and red in the face. But it's operating at a subtle level constantly. Now, what's very interesting about this sequence is that it can be transformed. People sometimes think, okay, this is the problem, and the way to solve this problem is just don't have any desires, or don't contemplate, don't meditate on any objects of the senses. Just become nothing.
Live in a cave.
Live in a cave. There was that Mahavir, for example, of the Jains, who lived like this for 13 years. And even he once got some big stick in his eye, and he didn't even complain. So many people think that, well, the way to deal with this problem, the way to become peaceful, is to just stop desiring anything. And the way to stop desiring anything is don't become aware of anything. Don't see anything. Don't hear anything. Don't smell anything. Don't taste anything. Don't touch anything. That kind of peace is had by, you know, this glasses case. This glasses case is not aware of any sense object. It has no desires. It has no attachments. It has no anger, no bewilderment. You could say that it's a very peaceful glasses case. But it's also dead. That solution is death. Now, ultimately, we cannot die. A little earlier in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "Ajo nitya shasvato yam purano," that we are a living being eternally. The body dies, but we don't die. So this solution would require death of us. And Krishna says, that's not possible. You cannot die. We can choose just about everything, but we cannot choose to cease to exist. We will always exist. So that way of attaining peace is looking for something that is impossible. It is looking for soul death. It is looking to become matter. The process given by Krishna is quite different. Because he tells us, Dayato, he's telling us to meditate also. And he's telling us to become attached even. If we go a little later in the Bhagavad Gita, of course this is throughout the Bhagavad Gita, but I'm just going to pick one of my favorites here. He says, Maya Shakta Mana Partha. Ashakta Mana. Ashakta means great attachment. Mana means mind. Krishna says, have great attachment of the mind to the Absolute Truth, to Krishna, to the Supreme. The same intensity, the same dhyana, the same meditation that we now have, you know, I want to get money, or I want to get the perfect partner, or I want to get the perfect house. And these things, we meditate on them. We meditate instead with the same intensity on the Absolute Truth. Okay, now what happens when we meditate on the Absolute Truth? We become attached also to truth. Our nature is to be attached. And that attachment also turns into a kind of lust. But to intensely desire something good and something true, and to be willing to pay any price, to not care about the consequences of achieving truth, does not lead to anger. Because truth doesn't disappoint us. It fills us. Like David says, my cup runneth over. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamidachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishite. The truth is full. Purnam, it's full, it's complete. If you take away something complete from it, it remains complete. That's truth. Therefore, when I touch the truth, I'm full. And it's an ever-flowing fullness. It's not static. It's dynamic. So therefore, there's no anger. And my desire, that intense desire for which I'm willing to pay any price, can even go on increasing. Because the satisfaction of it is also increasing. It doesn't get to a point where you say, okay, I've had this, I've had enough, I've seen it, done it, you know, let me go on to something else. There's no disappointment, there's no anger. Oh, but there is a kind of bewilderment, but is it a bewilderment of love? It's not a bewilderment of falsity, where one loses one's intelligence. One gains in intelligence. One gains in knowledge as much as a soul is able. One becomes full with knowledge. One sees everything in the right perspective. One sees everything as it is. If you've ever been in a maze, you know, a human maze, we have those big hedges. You ever been in a maze like that? You know, and there's sometimes there's somebody, nowadays at least, not when I was a little girl, but there's someone outside the maze with a camera. They can see where everybody is in the maze. So if anybody gets stuck, they can go rescue them. When I was little and went to Williamsburg, that kind of technology didn't exist. You just got lost in the maze. You know, but when I'm in touch with the truth, it's like that. I can see things as they are. I'm not bewildered. I have an overwhelming feeling of love. It says here, one falls down to the material pool. The fall that I have is I fall in love with the absolute truth. Which is, we could say falling in love is a kind of madness and a kind of delusion, but it's a very sweet madness. And it's based on truth. Because my ultimate love is the absolute truth. The relationship I have with the truth is that of love, of the reciprocation of love. So therefore, this kind of intense desire leads to simply a bewilderment of love, but to increased intelligence. And if one sees things as they are, I see that them I'm eternal. The absolute truth is eternal. Nothing can hurt me. I'm already complete. I already have everything that I need. I don't need any sense object for my happiness at all. Everything I need for my happiness, I already have. I don't need to go get it from somewhere. Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Rudeshirjana Chistati. The supreme truth is already within me. Everything I need to be complete is already there. And really, it's that simple. It's just that simple. Instead of saying, oh, I want that car because having that car will make me happy, it's, I want the absolute truth. I want Krishna. And I want Krishna to have a loving relationship. Not, I want the car so I can exploit it, so I can use it as I want. Destroy it if I want to. It's mine to use like that. No, I want Krishna to serve in love and never to exploit. And that's really all there is. That little shift. It's not a big shift. My spiritual master, Srila Prabhupada, he said, the difference between material consciousness and spiritual consciousness is very small. But just like if you have two parallel lines, all it takes is a little shift. You just need a millimeter shift for that line to go in a whole different direction. You know, just need to shift one note in there. This is part of the absolute truth. Mayatatamidam sarvam jagadavyaktamurti matstani sabhabhutane najahamte shirastita. This is all part of the absolute truth. It's not mine. It's not for me to enjoy by exploiting. It's for me to enjoy by reconnecting it with the truth. And that reconnecting is called yoga. And reconnecting in love, which we call bhakti yoga. Instead of trying to enjoy by exploiting, to enjoy by loving. The difference between rape and love. That's it. So then we just have to ask ourselves, you know, well, what am I meditating upon? What's driving me? And just like we don't notice the constant irritation of anger and frustration and irritation and annoyance and all the minor words for anger that we have, that we feel, that we don't notice, we're also not aware of what's driving us. We often think, oh yes, I really just want to love and I just want to find the absolute truth and I want to be in harmony with everything, and we don't really see. Am I an exploiter? So it's a question of becoming very reflective and very honest. And my dear friends, becoming honest is a somewhat painful experience. So I will warn all of you that if you take this path of bhakti yoga, there will be some pain. And the pain will mostly be when you look in the mirror and see, maybe I'm a little bit more materialistic than I had thought. But unless one sees oneself honestly, you can't make any improvement. You know, if you think you know everything, you can't learn anything, right? So part of this process of shifting our consciousness is seeing where we're going now. And there's some pain with that. I will warn you, there's a little bit of pain. But it's a nice kind of pain. It's sort of like when you're trying to figure out a problem and you're trying to figure out a problem and trying, and then you go, oh, that's where it is. That is working with my grandkids on math. And they'll say, Grandma, this is not wrong. I know it's right. I just know it's right. Why'd you mark it wrong? Look right there. Oh, and then you can fix it. If you don't see where the problem is, how can you fix it? So how do we get that ability to be self-reflective? How do we get that ability to know ourselves and to then come to the real truth? Well, it's so nice. The same process by which we ultimately connect with the supreme absolute truth and love is also the way by which we can see where we are and where we're going so that we can connect. And that is this chanting, is this mantra, this Hare Krishna mantra. When we're singing the Hare Krishna mantra, we are directly in touch with the supreme absolute truth and his energies. And Krishna acts as a sun. Right? And Ra, he acts as the sun. Tesham evanukampartam aham agyana jamtamaha nasaya yatma bhavosto gyana dipena bhashvata. Dipa is a light. Gyan means knowledge. So as soon as we're in touch with the great light of the absolute truth, then all of a sudden we see clearly. We see, oh, I've been an exploiter. I'm frustrated not because the government did this or this person at work did that, or that. I'm frustrated because I've been contemplating the objects of this world as being for my enjoyment. That's why I'm frustrated, and I've had an exploitive mentality. I don't like that anymore, and I think I'd like to do something about that. I think I'd like to be a real different kind of person, and I think I'd like to connect with Krishna. So chanting gives you that vision of reality. It takes you above the maze, so to speak. You see, here's where I am, and here's where to get out. And also chanting, ultimately, when one's out of illusion, is a way of expressing that love. Just like if you really love somebody, you know, there was, I'm sure some of you are around my age, there was some song when I was young, Hey, Hey, Paul, Hey, Hey, Paula, I Want to Marry You, or something like that. People like to say the name of someone they love. The whole song was practically just Paul and Paula. You know, or there still was one song, Gloria, Gloria, whatever, you know. Hey, Johnny Angel, I forget all the songs like that. But there's songs about people's names. They just say the name over and over and over and over again, Susan, 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 because they love that person. What to speak of when the name of the Lord is the same as him, because he's absolute. my name is a designation. You know, there's a difference between bag and this thing. But for the absolute truth, his name isn't a designation. So when one has fully realized oneself, chanting the mantra becomes not a way of realization and a way of purification, but a way of expressing that love and that connection and that yoga. And by chanting, one becomes aware, what am I meditating on? Where's my heart? Like Jesus says, don't put your heart in things that, you know, rot and mold and the thieves can take away. And we start to ask, where's my heart? Where do I think my happiness is coming from? And someone in this consciousness, it's not that they don't earn money or they don't have a house or they don't have a family, but they're not thinking that those things are the source of their happiness. They're thinking, my connection with Krishna is the source of my happiness. That's where my happiness comes from. And yeah, I can take care of my house, but you know, if my house burns down, that wasn't the source of my happiness. I may have to take care of this or that practical matter, but it wasn't the source of my happiness. My happiness was never dependent on that. My happiness comes from something else. So this is something to be asking ourselves really constantly. Where's my heart? Where's my attachment? What is it I want? What is it I'm convinced that if I had this thing, I would be complete and I would be happy? And if we really ask ourselves this, we'll probably find that the answer to that question is not really what we want it to be. Oh, if everybody liked me, if I had enough money, if I had perfect health, if I had the job I wanted, if I lived in Hawaii. Whenever I tell people I'm coming to Hawaii, they say, oh, you're so lucky. I said, you know, it's a place. I said, people are miserable in Hawaii too. You know, it's not that you go there, it's instant happiness, dust falls on you just because there's some water the color of your suit. With some pretty sea turtles swimming around. So this is our lesson here. Where do I have my heart? And then the very same desire and endeavor that brings us frustration and misery can bring us to unlimited happiness and knowledge. So, questions, comments, additions, subtractions, corrections? Yes?
Is there anything you can do with those material objects that might help them become more spiritual for me as a person surrounded by material objects? I mean, I may develop the intelligence to understand they're not going to give me permanent happiness, and I may not even pick up your mind, but... how can I make them really spiritual?
Well, when I start changing my mentality towards those objects, when I start seeing the sense objects as being the property of the absolute truth, and then I'm the steward of them, then I take care of them in a way that's in harmony with the desires of the owner. That's a science for which one needs generally some guidance. And Prabhupada says one needs very expert guidance, especially in the beginning, how to do that. Because, I mean, if I'm taking care of your property, I actually have to ask you, what do you want me to do with it? I can't just guess. I can't just say, well, I wonder if Kat would like me to use it this way or that way. I have to say, what would you like me to do with this? You know, if I'm house-sitting, I have to ask you, what do you want me to do? If I'm taking care of your dog, I mean, whatever, I have to ask you, how do you want me to care for it? So then one sees everything in relationship with the spirit, which it is. Then there actually, when one comes to that consciousness in one sense, there is nothing material anymore. In one sense, materialism is covering over us. It's something like when you're in an airplane and you see the shadows that the clouds are making on the ground. You ever seen that? Cloud-shaped shadows on the ground. So the cloud is, when you're on the ground, it looks like the sun's covered by clouds. But when you're above, you can see it's just a section of people that are covered by clouds. So really, illusion is within us. Illusion is something I'm carrying around in my heart. The world is truth. I'm just not seeing it properly. So when I start seeing all my sense objects as something that's part of the absolute truth and something that's meant to be used in his service, in Christian service, as he desires, then it regains its, for me, my covering gets moved away and I then can perceive it in its original aspect. Is that okay? I mean, specifically how to do that is a science. Yes?
So you said the answer to my question of how do you make matter spirit, you said reverse your class. What it sounds like is I'm just going to wait to get to the end of your class, where you're saying simply by looking at so-called material, spiritually, it becomes spiritual.
Yes, and if you look at spiritual things materially, it becomes matter. Actually, in one sense, everything from the point of view of Krishna, everything's spiritual. Just like from the point of view of the government, the prison is a government institution, the school's a government institution. If you're a government officer, you don't go into prison, even if you go into the prison. It's part of the government property. So from the point of view of God, everything's spiritual. So I've really turned something spiritual into material by my exploitive mentality. If you want to turn something spiritual to matter, want to exploit it and use it for yourself, and then you become covered and it becomes matter.
Isn't the simple way of understanding is if you see it separately from Krishna?
Yes.
Then it's material, if you see it in relationship to Krishna, then it's spiritual?
Yes.
Or also if you engage it in Krishna's service, like a car. I mean, wasn't that what Bhaktisiddhanta said? That things are, sannyasis weren't supposed to wear woven cloth. They weren't supposed to use typewriters. They weren't supposed to use vehicles. And he says, no, use them in Krishna's service. I'll use them to type,
yes,
compose my books. Yes. And so many things. And
well, seeing things, what you're saying is just exactly, thank you. And seeing separately or in relationship to Krishna is not just some theoretical construct. It's what do I do with it? If I say, yes, I see everything, everything's part of Krishna, everything's part of the absolute truth, but my mood is to exploit it for my own purposes, that's what it means to see things separately. Again, it's very simple. If I'm a guest in your home, like here, I come here, okay, I don't live here. And if I think that, oh, I'd like that, let me take it and use it for my own purposes. And I'm seeing it separately from the owner. But if I think, okay, let me be of some help here, maybe I can clean that, I'm seeing it in relationship to the owner. And if I see it in relationship to the owner, then I'll be welcome here. And if I try to see it separately, I won't be. And also, even when I'm here, I'll be feeling a lot of anxiety. You know, when are they going to find out that I stashed the thing in my bag, and am I going to get into trouble? And right, I'm going to be feeling a lot of anxiety. So it's the mentality, but it's the mentality as demonstrated in what I do with the thing.
How does chanting change the mentality, and how soon would it help?
So I said, chanting, you're directly in touch with the supreme absolute truth, which is all light and knowledge. So it's something like going into a dark room and turning on a light. You're immediately in touch with the light. How soon will it help? That depends on you. Now, how much attention do you give? You know, let's say I went to learn about physics. So I hang out with a physics professor. But then I don't listen to what he says. I was just saying this happens with my grandkids all the time. You know, they'll ask me a question, and then while I'm answering, they walk away. Well, I'll say, do you want to know the answer or not? So as soon as we're in touch with the supreme absolute truth, everything is lit up as the sun lights up everything in the daytime, but are we paying attention?
So the relief for material distress, which is one of the first symptoms in chanting, is that relief in the change of consciousness.
It's a change in consciousness, because distress is all of our distress is due to a mistaken consciousness. All of it. It's due to seeing something as something it's not, to seeing things in a way that's just not what it is. I think this world is a place for me to enjoy. I think this body is me. and therefore I feel distress. You know, if the drum isn't mine, why is it a source of happiness or distress for me? To me, the simple example is you're driving on the road and there's been a car accident. You see it's a bad accident and you may feel bad, but it's not heart-wrenching. But if it was your kid lying on the side of the road or your mother, why? Because there's attachment. I'm thinking my relationship with this person is a source of my happiness. Therefore, if this person is injured or killed, it's devastating. But, you know, you can read the newspaper any day and you see so many people have died in Iraq and Afghanistan and this place and that place. And, I mean, do you cry about it? Do you cry about that every time you see, you know, there's been an earthquake somewhere or there's been somebody got shot in St. Louis? I mean, do you sit down and cry? No, because we don't have any attachment. I don't know the person. So distress is caused by our attachment. I mean, even from just a technical point of view, you can put yourself in a trance and have surgery without anesthesia. The same knife is cutting into your skin. Why don't you feel it as pain? You've separated the attachment temporarily, mechanically. So if you actually separated the attachment, then there wouldn't be any more distress.
I think it would be very difficult to become detached from family members.
Yes, mm-hmm. It is.
So while that process is going on, a person that's getting that enlightened vision, how can they see their close associates, family members?
These are people been entrusted to me by Krishna to take care of. They're not the source of my happiness. I'm not getting my happiness by exploiting them or using them. I'm getting my happiness by taking care of them to please Krishna. It's quite different. That's like Jesus' example of the coins, the talents. Your master gives you some coins, you increase them. And the master comes back and says, "Well done, good and faithful servant. Your pleasure wasn't in increasing the coins or holding the coins. Your pleasure wasn't the fact that your master was pleased with you." So you have your family members, your children, your partner, your house, your car, your this. Something for you to take care of. This is the reciprocation of love that you have.
So I think that you have to know quite a bit about God or Krishna in order to know how to do this.
Yes, as I said, it's something that requires expert guidance, especially in the beginning. So it requires some guidance. You know, how to do that very specifically requires some guidance and generally some time. It's our exploitive mentality is very deep and very broad and very subtle. And getting rid of it all at one stroke generally is too much of a shock for most of us. It just doesn't happen usually that way. It's possible, but it doesn't usually happen. Generally, it's something gradual. You know, it's like sometimes people do cleansing. You know, you have to do it gradually or your system goes into shock. So usually it's gradual, that we gradually start realizing, hey, you know, I'm really more materialistic than I thought I was. The biggest shock is to see how exploitive we are, frankly. And usually we have to see that in very gradual, slow phases that we can deal with it. Sometimes I wish it wasn't like that, but that seems to be for most of us what it is like. And until you see things clearly, you can't give them up. So generally it takes some time. And unfortunately for many of us, it takes quite a while. Bahunam dhammanamante again. Can it be instantaneous? Yes. It is possible for it to be instantaneous. There are some examples in history, but that's unusual. And we often say, I want it to, you know, I want full self-realization instantly, but generally we don't really want. We have to get to the point, just like we're saying, a materialistic person wants something so much that they're willing to pay any price for it. They don't care, you know, my family be ruined, I'll lose my job as president of America, whatever. It just doesn't matter. You know, I just want to mess with this intern in the next 5 minutes, and whatever the consequences are for the rest of my life, you know, kind of heck with that. So we have to get to that point of intensity. We say, you know, I don't care what the consequences are. I don't care if my family rejects me and I become poor and I become crippled and I become sick and the whole world falls apart. I want the absolute truth, whatever the price may be. And that generally takes some time to get to the point where we really feel that way, where the same intensity of attachment that we have for materialistic things, that we have that for Krishna. And once we have that great intensity, then the process goes on.
It's a gradual increase in attraction.
Yes. Yes. Oh, and it's interesting you said that, because something I didn't so much emphasize was this idea of by meditation comes attachment. Mm-hmm. See, because everything is part of Krishna, everything has some fascination, which is why you'll find people write their PhD thesis on, you know, the one-toed, red-eyed, you know, mosquito that lives in one creek in Pennsylvania. Because anything, if you study it enough, it has some fascination to it because it's part of Krishna. You know, and the more that you study something and the more that you meditate on it, the more you will become attached to it. Now, what to speak of if you meditate and study on the whole? I mean, if that can be true for a tiny, tiny part of the whole, you know, if I could feel, if we got to know each other, I could feel great attachment and love for you, and you're just a little part of the whole. You know, people are willing to give their life for another person that they love or whatever, or for their house even, to speak of another person, their country. So the more I meditate on Krishna, the more I get to know about Krishna, the more I will naturally become. I'll naturally become attached. I'll naturally get this intense desire. And chanting also is like that. By chanting, I it's a way of meditating on Krishna. And I naturally become more and more attached. Just, I mean, unless I do something to really offend him. Yes?
When you say Krishna, you're talking about him. Some people say it's a her. You're making it very personal, as opposed to a consciousness or a universality of everything. What do you think the advantage is of personalizing that relationship versus recognizing it's part of the total?
Well, they're both true. Thank you for bringing that. That's a very good point. They're both true. The absolute truth is everywhere as existence, and everywhere also as existence and knowledge. But because absolute truth is complete, there must also be personal relationship. And there are those who say that the all-pervading existence and knowledge is higher. I'm personally convinced that the personal is higher. Because the depth of relationship you can have with the personal cannot be fully achieved in just the being and the knowledge. There's in the personal, the absolute truth is playful. The absolute truth in the form of just being and consciousness is very objective. Objectivity is not very much fun. And the ultimate expression of truth is fun and play. And it is, we use the word in Sanskrit, lila, which means sport. Or Prabhupada would translate it, pastime. Pastime, something you do, not because you have to, but just to do it. You know, we have pastimes like watching football. What is the value of watching football? So don't value. Something to do. So So the ultimate expression of the absolute truth is just simply this sport. Just play. And that is Krishna. As far as male or female, Hare is the feminine energy, and Krishna and Rama the masculine. So although one can say that ultimately the absolute truth is masculine, that's correct. One can also say correctly that the absolute truth is both masculine and feminine. That's also correct. It depends on how you're going to examine. They're both true. The complete, therefore, you see, our worship is of Radhe or Hare and Krishna, the masculine and the feminine. We do not worship Krishna without Radha. And that is complete. And sometimes they exist as one person, which is on the right, all the way on the right of the altar. Mm-hmm. It's Chaitanya. That is both masculine and feminine, together in the same form. It exists. The absolute truth exists in an ultimate form that is both masculine and feminine, and an ultimate form, two separate forms. That this, of course, they're not masculine and feminine in the sense that we think of it in this world, in terms of, you know, mating and reproduction kind of thing. It's not exactly. But it's the prototype from which our conceptions of masculine and feminine in this world have come. In fact, we could say that is the real masculine and feminine, and what we have is an imitation. We have a reflection and an illusion. So you can't really put quite our ideas of masculine and feminine onto the spiritual, but it is the prototype. And then you see in these pictures that you see masculine. So, in fact, even the Om, you know, just like in English, we occasionally have, you saw something about what I do with my life. We occasionally have times when there's two vowels together and you pronounce each vowel separately, like skiing or vacuum.
It happens in Hawaiian a lot.
And yeah, in this island it's, you know, what I was saying, oh, I go on Kunuli Street, and they say, no, it's Kino'ole or something. Right? Yeah, all over the place. But generally in English, anyway, we occasionally have that, but usually two vowels combine together to make another sound. You know, EA makes E, like steam. So in Sanskrit, whenever you have two vowels together, they combine in what's called sandhi to make another sound. So you have a, which is, a is the most elemental sound, which Krishna says later in the Gita represents him. It's a sound that you make if you're not using your tongue or your teeth or your lips at all, just a, and then u, au, au. If you say au, 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 over and over, it becomes o, and then m. So that's how you get om, is from ah, ooh, om. And ah represents the masculine, ooh, the feminine, and all of us. So that is the supreme, everything is contained in that. Or the Hare Krishna mantra, Hare is the feminine, Krishna and Rama is the masculine. So that's everything. That's all of reality. But one can also say the absolute truth is masculine. That's also correct. Is that okay? Different way of looking at it. Am I going too late?
In the middle.
And you're right there. Is there anything else? Yes.
Just to close on your point about God is and God isn't. He is person and he is also not a form. So I remember talking with one Christian, and he designated me as a Hindu. Well, I said, yeah, I guess I'm like a Hindu. And he says, oh, so you guys have many gods. And I also told him the same thing. I said, well, it depends a little bit on how you look at it. And I said, in Christianity, is there many gods or one God? There was nowhere, one God. And I said, well, because, you know, with the devotees, we say that Krishna is God, and Jesus is the Son of God. And he goes, no, Jesus is God. And I said, well, you're not going to tell me that the Holy Ghost is also God. He goes, well, it is. It's the Trinity. All three of us. And I said, so does many mean more than two? And he goes, yes. And I said, well, then you have many gods. So it is, and so it concluded to the same thing, that it a lot of these things, from God's perspective, it's one and it's many at the same time. And from our perspective, which is very limited and very linear, and we're always trying to break things down, we keep finding these distinctions, but for the Lord, they're all part extensions of Him.
Thank you. I guess as far as many gods, I would say that most of the many gods that people associate with Hinduism are not forms of the absolute truth, but they're more equivalent in Christianity to angels and archangels and persons like that. And, you know, if we saw one of those persons, we might become confused and worship them. And that sort of thing has happened. And then people think, oh, yes, they're like God. They're another god.
We get confused with movie stars, so let's
speak. What to speak of if we saw some angels walking around? We might, yeah, people definitely worship movie stars. Was there anything else that anybody wanted to bring up? Thank you very much. I hope this was helpful. If I said anything that wasn't helpful, just please ignore it. And anything I said that was useful, I hope you can take it on board and that it can be of some value to you in your life. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.